I'm going to be complimenting Kirk's talk a little bit. I'm coming at it from a slightly different angle. I'll be talking today about assessing contaminant bioavailability when we have no choice but to use the in vitro gastrointestinal models. My name is Nick Bost. I'm from Ohio State. And I want to pick up with the excavation question. Why do we care at all about bioavailability and making adjustments? And it's because usually it's the most expensive thing you could do is to excavate soil, haul it away, and replace it. And so almost, you know, it's worth looking at if we could avoid this excavation issue. So how do you do that? You can do a bioavailability adjustment that prevents the unnecessary digging up and hauling away of soil that may have contaminants that aren't bioavailable. And I'm going to be leaning more towards urban soils rather than mining sites. And these are actual sites. This one, for example, in Cleveland, where that question is being considered right now. Do we dig up these yards and gardens and haul them away and replace them with soil or make an adjustment? So how do you measure bioavailability? I showed this picture. I was actually in a meeting at Case Western University with a large number of professors from the medical profession. And I introduced myself first as soil chemist. I got a strange look. And then I told them, I'm the soil doctor. And they said, oh, we didn't know we had soil doctors. And I said, yes, we diagnose and treat soils. And so I think it's effective communication if you're ever talking to people in the public health area. But when you look at bioavailability, which pathways are we going to worry about for that person with that urban garden? And honestly, when you look at the risk driver, it's going to be ingestion for lead and arsenic. For very insoluble elements, most of the exposure you're going to get is from dust or from soil that's on consumed vegetable products or just working in that material. So this becomes a focal point. I mean, it's important to look at what gets into the plants, but it's more important to look at what dissolves if the soil is ingested. Okay, and so then how do you assess that pathway? And this is the pathway we're talking about, human ingestion. How do you measure the bioavailability for soil ingestion? We actually use animal models that Kirk was talking about. These are trials are costly, lengthy, not easily obtained. If you want primate dosing, there's one person in the country, and he's busy. Swine, I can count them on one hand. So it's not an easy data to get, even if you have the money. But if you get the data, you and you're a good risk assessor, you can easily incorporate RBA to make those adjustments for bioavailability. So it is data that is worth getting a hold of. It's just difficult with animal models sometimes. And that's why we have these in vitro gastrointestinal models, which are basically extraction methods, soil extraction methods that simulate the human GI conditions, the chemical conditions. We don't measure bioavailability because it's all in vitro. It's in glass and a beaker. What we measure is how much dissolves, how much we dissolved, and we term that bioaccessible. It's in a form where it can be absorbed into the body, but it hasn't been. So we talk about bioaccessibility. So we're talking about an extraction method followed by some type of metal analysis, maybe by ICP. And usually we express the bioaccessibility as a percent of the total. So it's a percent IVBA, which is how much you dissolve divided by the total in the soil. Are these methods accepted? We have a lot of different methods out there. Which ones are acceptable or not? Which tests do you use? In 2007, EPA gave us some excellent guidance documents to help us out with criteria that would lead towards an accepted method. And so this guideline is I would highly recommend if you're testing soils or developing methods, consult this document if you want it to be used for contaminated sites. But a key thing I want to bring out with in vitro methods is they must be correlated with an acceptable in vivo model, and it must be predictive. So your method has to be able to predict bioavailability. And how many methods are there? Well, the 13 become very quickly very few. You go from 13 to very few where this has been done. One where it has been done is lead. So RBLLP method published by Drexler and Bratton has been accepted. EPA has accepted guidance. And why? Because they've shown a nice correlation between in vitro and lead RBA measured by juvenile swine. So this has met all the criteria necessary. So actually, you could use this method now for assessment, for risk assessment, for data. You could run this extraction instead of the swine dosing. As Kirk mentioned, arsenic is still out there. There's still a variety of methods people are working on. We have one, for example, that where we show the our in vitro method correlates with swine for a limited number of soils. But this is the type of data you have to have. You have to have the correlation data between the in vitro and the animal model, and it has to be predictive. Actually, another nice method, the SBRC method, modified by Albert Huas. He's just published work for lead and for arsenic, where they've actually got a nice correlation between their method and, let me reverse these axes, but the in vitro method and the bioavailability method. So there are some methods out there. There are a lot more where the correlations haven't been done, and those methods are out in limbo. We don't know what to think about those. We all have ICPs, or a lot of people do, and so what happens after you extract it? You open up all the channels and you read all the elements. And then you report metal bioaccessibility for, you know, vanadium, whatever you're interested in. Can you use that data? No. EPA says you have to have, the in vitro method has to be correlated with an acceptable animal model. How many correlation studies have we had with animal models for how many elements in the periodic table? Lead, some arsenic, one study with cadmium, one with nickel, and none with the rest. So eventually, if these methods are going to be used for measuring 10 or 12 or 15 elements from ingestion, they're going to have to be correlated or shown to be correlated with an animal model. What kind of soils have we done these correlation studies on? Highly contaminated ones. Some of the studies have been done on highly contaminated. For example, the study I mentioned before, the accepted method, the RBALP, was done on contaminated soil, 19 solid waste materials from smelter origin, ranging from 1,500 to 14,000, averaged 7,000 part per million lead. That's pretty high, 7,000 part per million lead. So these were highly contaminated materials. And so you might say, okay, if you did use a test and you find a bioavailability or bioaccessibility is 20%, can you make an adjustment and leave the soil there and not excavate it? I would think it would be very difficult if it was highly contaminated, because even with the adjustment, you're going to have too much risk. You at 7,000 part per million or above, when you're talking about a screening level of 400, you have to effectively reduce it below that point, and you would need more than 90% reduction, and nobody's going to accept a 90 with uncertainty that kind of number. So really, the soils that you're probably going to work with are not these highly contaminated ones. It's going to be the moderately ones where you're going to be able to make an adjustment for bioavailability or bioaccessibility. And the good news is that's the most of the soils we deal with. Most of the soils are not the heavily contaminated ones. They're ones that people get exposed to daily with moderate levels of risk from lead paint in urban areas or pesticides or CCA or et cetera. Their urban areas are old brownfield sites. The second thing is in vivo models. In vivo models, many of them require fairly high concentrations of contaminants so that they could actually measure the arsenic in the urine or the blood in the lead. So, or the lead in the blood. And so you have to have a higher concentration. Moderately contaminated soils may be below the detection limit. So now if you come with a soil that's contaminated with 80 part per million arsenic, I may not be able to give you a number from an animal dosing trial, but I could from an in vitro method, okay? So in the moderately contaminated, where we may have most of our soils, we may be stuck with IV only in vitro methods, but that's the strength of those methods. We could actually go to a very low level and get a very, we could measure background soil in vitro if we wanted to. The question is that acceptable? Is that acceptable for these soils? If we're measuring a small level and we don't have, it's below the in vivo detection limit, are we confident to use those methods for very, very low levels? The other question is, can we use a method that was shown, an in vitro method correlated with an animal for an orchard, can we use it in an urban garden on lead paint? Or do we have to do a correlation study for one for lead paint in urban gardens, one for orchards? A better approach is to use contaminant speciation. Is to say, what are the species that were in the urban garden that we found the correlation for? And then that maybe that'll work across different soils. If it's the same species in the orchard soil, we're fine. It'll apply there too. I'm just going to run a few slides just to give you an idea of how some of this might work. We have a method that correlated with an animal model, so it met that criteria. The in vitro correlated with an acceptable animal model. And we went the next step, and actually Dr. Shekel showed that for our soils, there was a correlation between the species that seemed to be driving availability here with scorodite in the sample. So now we knew that we had this correlation with the vitro method. We also knew that scorodite was related to what we were seeing in the animal model. And then we did some simple chemical extractions and found that most the arsenic that was associated in the iron pool from several extractions was also correlated with the animal model. So now we start to build evidence of, okay, the in vitro seems to be working for these types of species. And the literature has other information to support this too, where bioaccessible arsenic is inversely related to bioavailability and bioaccessibility. So there's other published work showing, you know, with what we measure in the in vitro seems to be inversely correlated with what's in the iron fraction. And tomorrow, Shane Whitaker, who's here, will be giving a presentation on soil controls and arsenic bioaccessibility, and he'll be going in depth on this, on looking at this relationship. And I won't tell you any more, except there's some very good relationships. So 2:45 is the time to see the rest of that. The idea is we could extrapolate this method probably for highly contaminated soils to moderately contaminated soils if the source term of the contaminant is similar. Okay, so arsenic sorbed iron, I know that's a big category, you know, that's where we're at. The good news is that's a likely source term for many of the soils we have. Arsenic tends to be associated. So we have some evidence that maybe we can extrapolate down to lower levels below in vivo levels if we know that the arsenic is associated with iron oxide. I get this question a lot. How do I pick a method if I go into a garden area in urban soil? And I don't think there's much difference between our in vitro methods or any other soil test method. You know, our soil methods books are excellent because they'll tell you right up front, they'll give you a procedure and a theory, and then right after the procedure and theory, it'll be 2 pages of comments of when the method doesn't work. It doesn't work all the time. We don't have a method that works all the time. So I would hope that these in vitros would tell us when the test works and doesn't work. And so there are cases they don't work. And so the other thing is, has the method been correlated with in vivo models for your element of interest, or your contaminant of interest? Has it been correlated for your metal species? Is it lead paint, lead carbonate? Or is it lead scalena, lead sulfide in amining waste? Has it been correlated with an animal model for your contaminant species? And that's where the large number of samples and sources are needed. And the contaminant level. Have you measured, correlated your method, has the method been tested for 80 part per million arsenic or just for 10,000 part per million arsenic? Because it's going to be a big difference. At the lower levels, the soil controls might be greater and you may not get the correlation than at the higher levels. And because of this, we have a lot of different methods we use in the lab, not just one. And so we actually have several methods that we were using depending on what they've been validated for. And so with that, I'll open up to questions. Thank you for your attention. We have time for a couple. Yes, Ron.
For the in vivo methods, are you looking for any type of analytical methods that would lower your detection limit so that you might be able to get a few points at the lower end and not be extrapolating, but rather verifying?
That's a good question. Can we get lower with the in vivo model? And actually, it doesn't turn out to be a detection limit issue. The instrumentation, we can get lower. We can measure lower arsenic in urine or lead in blood. It becomes an animal limiting issue because there's a natural background of arsenic in our urine or in animal urine. And so that's where the detection is. It's a physiological base. So that's where we run into the limitation. So if you can, if there is such a thing that we have zero arsenic urine, then we can get lower or lower.
So you might have to pre-degeneration or two later on.
Yeah. All these dosing trials are done with special feeds and materials that are very low trace element to try to get that detection limit lower. But even with that, it's hard. I know in Australia, Dr. Huas has actually used blood arsenic to get lower. And he's had some cases where he's managed to get below 100 part per million arsenic, but it's tricky work. And the problem with the mice might be how much can you feed mice with soil, you know? So that's the other thing, is your detection limit may, if you feed less soil, you may have trouble with your detection limits. So you have to have hungry mice. Okay, well, thank you. If that's it, thank you for attending the session.